Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, we had a bit of cloud cover here to start off our day. We even had a few light showers move through the Salt Lake Valley. And also, you may or may not have seen some flurries here around Park City this morning as well. But things are coming to an end for the most part. We'll still see some lingering mountain snow showers at times today and into the evening hours as there is some more snow showers on the way tonight as a little weak disturbance comes by and brings another little dosage of some accumulating snowfall to our mountains. 1 to 3 is the likely scenario in this instance. But this is all a precursor to what will be a significant winter storm to impact the area late tomorrow night into Friday. This is associated with an atmospheric river that is pushing into the west coast, but the trajectory is nearly perfect for Utah to see substantial water in the form of both rainfall for valleys and snow for the mountains. Now, currently, there's a winter storm watch for our mountains of northern Utah, the Wasatch Mountains, and the western Uintas for heavy snowfall of about 1.5 feet in the highest locations with locally higher amounts from there. Park City proper is not under any advisories or watches or warnings at this time, but you can expect 3 to 6 inches of snow. With this event, it will be fairly high water content because temperatures will be on the warmer side of things with this storm. But it will create travel impacts here, especially Thursday night into the Friday morning commute. So that's something that you need to be aware of as we progress closer to this. After that storm passes through and things quiet down later Friday, then we're looking at storm number 2 arriving hot on its heels for Saturday. This will be an all-snow event for Park City. As of now, we don't have any watches or warnings for that one. It's still a little bit too far out, but it should be all, and it should be substantial snow because it will linger into Valentine's Day with a third winter storm coming in Monday into Tuesday. It will be colder, too. So that means, again, another snow event with more accumulating snow. This is an absolutely fantastic pattern and setup and something that we've been waiting all winter for, and it finally is here. And, yes, it does impact your holidays and your Valentine's Day travel or what you're planning on doing. But overall, this is what we need, and we are going to see the snow pile up over the next 7 days.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
And with a look at the conditions in the backcountry on the phone with us, we've got Trent from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, what an exciting weather pattern we have coming up. But, you know, we also need to remember that with all this snow, that our avalanche danger is going to be on the rise over the next couple of days through the weekend, possibly hitting high or maybe even extreme if this weather event actually comes to fruition. So stay tuned on that. But for today, you kind of heard the weather. We have a moist kind of westerly flow. Winds along the upper elevation ridgelines, they're mostly behaving. And they're in the 5 to 10 mile per hour range with gusts into the 20s. The mountain temperatures, they'll be a little bit on the warmer side today with temperatures climbing into the 20s at, 10,000 feet in the low 30s at about 8,500 feet there in our mountains. Yesterday, it was the first time in a very long time that we had no new avalanches reported from the backcountry. Does that mean it's safe? I don't think so. I just think that, that no new avalanches were triggered, which is a good thing. And we're kind of out of that natural avalanche activity. And now where we sit today is where humans can actually trigger the avalanche and get caught and carried. We've talked about it all winter long. We have this persistent weak layer issue, and we just need to remember that dangerous avalanches, 2 to 5 feet deep and hundreds of feet wide, are still possible. You know, these conditions are most pronounced on steep northwest through southeast. So that means any slope that's northwest, north, northeast, and east, as well as southeast at those upper elevations. So that includes that entire Park City ridgeline. Is pretty dangerous, and this is where we could see avalanches breaking very deep. The bottom line with this problem and this avalanche situation that we have right now throughout northern Utah, I'm speaking to the Park City Ridgeline and the Wasatch Mountains, but this problem really does exist throughout much of Utah. And the bottom line here is that there's no outsmarting this. Like, our snowpack is weak. We have a very dangerous slab of snow on top of this weak layer, and avoidance is our answer. So if you're going to head out into the backcountry today, be sure to stick to terrain that's under 30 degrees in slope steepness. And remember that these avalanches can be triggered from the bottom or even from the flat. So if you're in relatively flat terrain, but just above you, there's a big steep bowl, or that bowl is adjacent to you, you got to remember, we can trigger the avalanche from the flats, and then this thing will come down and overrun us in the bottom. These avalanches are running hundreds and hundreds of feet long. So, yeah, it's a bummer. I wish I could say, hey, let's go out and, you know, ride some really great snow. But the truth is that we've got to steer clear of avalanche terrain. And our bottom line avalanche danger today is considerable avalanche danger. And again, I described those upper elevation slopes where you can find that danger. And recent snowfall and strong winds have overloaded our snowpack. And if you trigger an avalanche out there, you could expect it to be 2 to 5 feet deep and several hundred feet wide. And most likely it'll be unsurvivable.
Okay, Trent, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the executive director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council, Jocelyn Scott. She's got details about the virtual winter arts showcase. And Highland Flats developer Adam Breen with details on the proposed development in Highland States, proposing more than 400 new rental apartments and townhomes. Finally, in the hour, Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bola with his monthly update. Stay tuned. The Arts Council of Park City and Summit County is hosting its Winter Arts Showcase this month, and it will be done virtually. On the phone with details, the Executive Director of the Arts Council, Jocelyn Scudder. Good morning, Jocelyn.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell us, what is the Winter Arts Showcase?
Sure. Some of you may remember this Winter Arts Showcase event in past. Last year, we held a physical art show at the Park City Community Church, and we had about 30 artists represent their goods, and it was over President's Weekend, so it was a three-day event. And there have been a couple iterations of this event. We also used to partner with the Swanner Eco Center, and the show was called Art Elevated, but we outgrew the space. There was a lot of demand from local artists wanting to participate. So we shifted to the Park City Community Church last year. We were able to have 30 artists, and of course this year we are having to be nimble and inventive and experimental. So we are prioritizing the health of our community and, of course, our artists, and presenting a virtual version of the showcase this year that can be found on an e-commerce site that we launched right at the beginning of COVID called createpc.org. And it's going to launch on Friday. We're really excited. It's going to run through the end of the month, so people will have an ample time period and opportunity to discover and explore and shop local art.
Okay, so it's you. If I went there right now, I wouldn't see anything. It won't happen until Friday?
Yes, very good point, and that's something I wanted to make sure we mention. The website is still, it isn't yet launched. It's not live. We are, building some enthusiasm for Friday and making sure that we have all the details and all of the artwork ready to go for sale online. So we're still working on that and fine-tuning the details, and it'll be ready. If you go to createpc.org, you'll see that we have an exhibitions page, and you'll be able to find the Winter Art Showcase there with, again, 40 artists, which I suppose might be a silver lining if we're, you know, of course, a virtual show does not have the same energy as an in-person event, which I know we're all craving, but in the end, we feel fortunate that we can offer a virtual event and have the capacity to do that. And we've been able to accept more artists than ever. We have a lot of new artists that have never been in the show. So we're really excited to present their work and provide an avenue for our local artists to sell work. Of course, this has been a challenging year for everyone, artists included. And so it's absolutely a priority for us to be able to offer the platform and promote sales for our artists.
Okay.
But yes, please don't go to createpc.org just yet, but please come visit us Friday, February 12th, and we hope that, you know, you all find it, or our community finds it easier than ever to discover local art from the comfort of your own home. I know a lot of us have been home a lot lately, but that's where we are these days, so why not check out some local art and support our local creative sector while we're at it?
Okay, you're going to kind of introduce the artists that you've got during a Facebook Live event happening Friday night, 6 o'clock?
Correct, yeah. We are doing our best to emulate a live, exciting launch event. So we're going to do that via Facebook Live on Friday, starting at 6 p.m. It's going to be 1 hour. So people can engage with this live Facebook Live event on our Facebook page. It's just Park City Summit County Arts Council. We're going to be featuring five artist talks. So five of our participating artists who've been selected in the show are going to be giving us a little studio tour. They're going to be telling us about their process. We have someone who is a painter, a digital artist, a woodworker, and so we have a variety of media represented in this show. And then on Friday, we'll have this live launch event where you can meet some of the artists, get to know them, connect with them, and hopefully you'll be intrigued to explore their art and maybe start a collection.
All right. So then after Friday night, when somebody logs on to createpc.org, what are they going to see?
So they're going to see a page of everything is going to be sorted by artists. So you can explore artwork depending on that artist and their medium. So if you go to a specific artist page, you can see each artist has put up to 10 pieces of artwork for sale online. And artwork really ranges in this show. Again, I think I mentioned it before, but we have sculptures, ceramics. We even have textiles and scarves. So it's artisanal goods and fine art. Then there's also a really huge range of price ranges as well. So I think when I think about a show like this, something that I love to present is there's something for everyone in the show. We have jewelry. One of our main goals is to highlight the artist and their story. So when you go to the page, we highlight their artists. You can explore their art that way. Some of them have given us studio tour videos. We have a little bio about them. So providing connection points for our local artists and allowing for our community to get to know them is absolutely a goal of the show, and so we hope that this online platform will provide that.
All right, so if a piece is purchased, then it just kind of disappears from the website?
Yes, so we will be managing that very closely, the Arts Council will be managing all of the art sales, and then once someone purchases a piece of artwork, we will connect that collector with the artist directly. We also think that connection is really important. Then that person will either arrange, if the person is local buying a piece of art, they can always arrange a pickup or drop-off scenario that is safe and comfortable. Or if someone is out of state, we can set up shipping, and that will happen through the artist. Another silver lining is just that we can reach a much wider audience with an online show, and so people who have family from out of town, visitors who love our community and want to support our creative community will have an opportunity to interact with this show and support our local talent that lives here. This is a true experiment. We've done one virtual show. We did a monster drawing rally. Some of you may remember that last spring. We're experimenting and trying new things in this very strange time. So we really hope that people join us, check out the Winter Art Showcase on createpc.org and support our show.
All right. And if somebody purchases something, how do they get the item?
Yeah, so we'll be arranging. There's two avenues to receive artwork, either shipping, and this will be up to the buyer. They can choose to have it shipped, or they can choose to pick it up if they are local at a drop-off location or what have you. So there's going to be a little bit of logistical organizing in between the sale and actually retaining the piece. But this is how we did the virtual show in spring, and it worked out really, really well. So we're feeling positive that it's going to work out great.
All right. You mentioned 40 artists participating. Was this a juried show, or just really anybody who wanted to participate was allowed to?
Our goal was really to be as inclusive as possible. You know, of course, during this year, but you know, any year, we want to be supportive and foster growth with all of our local artists. And so, anyone who wanted to participate, we welcomed into the show. And this year, because it was an online platform, usually when we are in a space, we can be limited to, say, square footage limitations, right, and can only accept 30 or 25 artists, because if artists have a, you know, certain size booth, we can only squeeze so many in a space. So this year, because of our virtual platform, we were able to be as inclusive as possible and welcome all the artists who wanted to participate into the show, as long as they met the criteria, which was being a Summit County resident or a member of the Park City Professional Artists Association. So I think that is giving us a great glimpse into the range of artistic talent that exists here in Summit County and our surrounding counties.
Okay. Now, is the Main Street Makerspace and retail shop, are they open for business?
Well, that's a great question, Leslie. You are going to be the first to hear this. We are going to be launching a new space in the pop-up location on Main Street that we've been overseeing for the last 2 months or so. Some of you may be familiar with the holiday pop-up shop Brand PC that we launched in December, where we support creative entrepreneurs and their goods and wares. It's very product focused, and it's a great time in December for people to shop local. We've been in that space at 544 Main Street in partnership with Vacasa Real Estate, who is our host sponsor, since December, and they've been incredibly generous to let us remain in that space through March 31st. And so we are in the process of flipping the pop-up, and we are going to launch Create PC, which used to be at the Zoom space. Some of you may remember there was a pop-up in 2020 called Create PC that was an intersection of studio space and gallery space of local artists. This space that we're currently in for the pop-up is smaller, so the activations may look a little different, but the core of the program and the root of it all is that we're supporting local artists, giving them exposure on Main Street, being additive. Most of these artists that we're representing do not already exist in, say, a gallery on Main Street. And so we are literally in the process of hanging that show, hoping to be up by Monday. And we will, as soon as we are up and confident that the space is presentable, we will send out a press release and you guys will hear all about it.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention then?
Only thing I did want to mention is 100% of these art sales do go back to the artists when you buy a piece of artwork. And so I think that's a really important thing to remember. You are truly supporting a local artist when you go to createpc.org and participate in the Winter Art Showcase. Otherwise, we hope you join us for our live launch event on Friday, February 12th at 6 p.m. on our Facebook Live. Learn and get to know some of our artists and, you know, support us in this strange time where we're experimenting and trying new things. So we really appreciate the community support, our visitor support, and we're excited.
All right. Thanks, Jocelyn.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Jocelyn Scudder is the Executive Director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Summit County Sheriff's Office had a spate of calls last week from residents in Jeremy Ranch concerned about harassment and invasion of privacy due to menacing drone activity. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on that.
Last weekend, Jeremy Ranch resident Susan Haymaker and her husband went out for an evening walk. They found themselves dealing with a drone noisily flying very close by for about 10 minutes.
Went above our head 7 or 8 feet up, and then it went behind us and followed us. And we kept walking, and we turned right, and the drone kept following us at that close, so it was very loud. It kept following us very close, so close that when I started saying, I'm not going to look at it, I'm just going to keep walking. You felt like it was so close to your head that it could potentially touch you.
Haymaker said it was a disturbing and total invasion of privacy, and she didn't want to walk home for fear that the drone operator would know where she lived. Summit County Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright said the complaints recently received include several people calling to report drone harassment, and he noticed a flurry of social media comments. He said if you want to operate an unmanned aerial vehicle, a UAV, there are several Utah laws that apply.
You can be criminally charged if you are going into people's property, crossing fence lines, going into their backyards, if you're going up to people's windows. It's obviously a violation of people's privacy. You have to understand the FAA regulations on how high you can fly them. If you're specifically flying them around people's homes or around people that are walking, you're towing the line of violating the law of criminal trespass or even voyeurism.
Jeremy Ranch resident Craig White reported his drone stolen after performing an emergency landing on the Jeremy Ranch golf course. It took him about 10 minutes to get to the location. He could see the marks in the snow where it landed, but the drone was gone. Whoever took it knew enough to turn off the receiver, so White would not be able to locate it through his controls.
They had to have had like either a DJI Mavic Air 2 or the DJI Mini also. You can use the same controller on. So I imagine them or one of their friends had one, you know, an extra controller. On the 28th, there was three drones flying around, harassing. One was off in the distance. There was two, a Mavic Air 2 and a DJI Phantom. They were kind of like in cahoots.
White said the people who stole it moved quickly to resync it to their controller. The company DJI would be able to identify the drone's location because they have flight logs based on the serial number. But White said he couldn't access that data due to privacy regulations. He said only law enforcement personnel could request the flight data. He said his own drone harassed him after it was stolen.
The drone that was stolen from me was the actual one that was coming down and looking into my window with me and my wife in the house. I ran my cell phone to record it, and it took off. It was just the very same day that it was buzzing some other people in the street.
White is a drone hobbyist. He specializes in sunrises, sunsets, and wildfires. He said most operators follow the laws that include not flying drones over crowds and only flying them in places within the operator's eyesight. During the same time period, Jeremy Ranch Elementary School reported to the sheriff's office a drone flying over the playground during a recess period.
First of all, people should not be flying over large crowds of people. Second of all, children, and you're not supposed to be photographing or anything without parents' consent. They may have not been recording, who knows, you know, but that would be pretty creepy if they were.
Lieutenant Andrew Wright said if drones are harassing people, they want to be called immediately. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, a 400 all rental unit development proposal in Highland Estates will be before the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission at its February 23rd meeting. On the phone to tell us more, I have Adam Breen with Breen Homes, one of the partners in this proposed development. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So give us the background here. I mean, where is this explain what you're proposing here?
Yeah, so Highland Flats is a piece of land just on the south side of I-80 and the west side of I-40, a corridor just off Highland Drive. We're proposing some affordable or workforce housing development that would be, just as you mentioned, about 410 units. And what's really important to know about this, I'd love to get into nuts and bolts if you'll let me really quickly. Affordable, everyone says, what's affordable? Park City is not affordable. And I think that if you understand what that is, it's incredibly important to know. AMI, when you see that, it means area median income. Right now, for a single person in Park City, the AMI, or the area median income, is just under $80,000. So when we propose something that is at a 30% AMI, we're catering to a person that is making $23,919 a year, an affordable unit to him. So what that actually means, a one-bedroom, one-bathroom unit at 30% AMI would be rented at $598 a month. That's really affordable when you talk the ability to live for workforce housing in Park City.
Okay, so of these 410, how many of them are going to be at 30% AMI?
We've got in between 30 and 80% AMI would be 144 units.
Okay, and then the rest of them are all rentals?
So the rest of them, all of them are rentals, all 410 units. The remaining units on there, 45% of them, or 180 units, would be considered moderately affordable. That would fit in between somebody in that 100 to 120% AMI, and only 86% of the units would be market rate units.
Okay. Is it based on who shows up to rent these then of that 144 between 30 and 80%, or are just five of them going to be 30%, you know, 20 of them are going to be 35%? I mean, how are you going to break that up?
Yeah, great question. We do have a full breakdown of what goes in between, how many are 30 exactly, how many would fall in between 40, 50, 60, 70%. So we have broken that down. That is a variable number that we're working with the Planning Commission on what could be possible for us to do. Now, another really important thing to see is we care about the workforce community in Park City. So what we're trying to do is make sure that those people that need the affordability and are working in Utah get the first right to rent those units. So any units that fall between that 30 and 80% AMI would be people that are working and living directly in Park City. They wouldn't be second homes.
Okay. So this 40-acre piece of property, do you own it or do you just have an option on it at this point? Pending.
We currently own about half of it. We have an option on the other half. So the Catholic Church owns the other half. We have an option on that. We've been working directly with them, and we have committed to donating 10 acres back to them that they plan to build a Catholic diocese on in the future.
Okay. I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit, but currently, how is the property zoned?
Currently, the property zone is R120, which is one home per 20 acres. So it's very open space to a degree. The zoning around that area is a mix between Silver Creek and the Highland Estate subdivisions, where you see some single family, you see some higher density.
Right. But those are more like one per five, no? Around Highland Estates? One per...
You know, I'm not exactly sure what Highland Estates itself is. I would say it's probably tighter than one per five, but I'm not exactly positive.
Sure. So this is pretty dense. I mean, we're talking about 10 units per acre, yeah?
Yeah, just under 10 units. It's about 9.5 units per acre.
Yeah. Will that require then a conditional use or a rezoning? What are you going to be before the Planning Commission with?
So we've got to go in for a general plat amendment and a conditional use and then a rezone. So we understand this is an uphill battle. You know, we also recognize that when people see density, their first reaction is, no, not in my backyard. I don't want to see this. But you also have to understand that it is the countervailing public interest that people have affordable housing. And it's horrible in Utah. It's bad in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's bad in Park City. Everyone sees that they cannot afford the next step. They can't afford to be in a home. They can't afford to live in a home. And it's only getting worse. Building costs are going up. Development costs are going up. It's an area that we all see that needs to be fixed, yet people aren't willing to see it in their backyard. We truly believe that this spot, being right against I-80 and against I-40, is a good spot to allow density. I understand that it's really, really hard on people. Change is always tough in a neighborhood when you've been there for many years. Whether it's for good or for bad, change is tough. So I think it's very important for people to understand that even though people don't want it in their backyard, it is something that's needed. I've commuted to Park City plenty of times over the past year as I've built construction in the area and recreated in the area. And the traffic getting off the exits in the morning is really, really, really tough. You know, as they continue to have the influx of workers trying to work and be in the community and the traffic goes in and out, it's going to continue to grow and get worse that way if they don't allow some density that allows some affordability in the area.
Yeah. So you have prepared a traffic study for the project at 410 units. What does it tell you?
You know, there's been multiple traffic studies prepared when Silver Creek was first proposed and approved. As you would expect, the off-ramps and on-ramps of Park City Junction and then what I call the Home Depot exit, they continue to get more and more crowded. They fail. That isn't caused by the potential development of our subdivision. That's caused by the growth of the community in the area. What our traffic study does show is that it does increase. In fact, it almost doubles the traffic on Highland Drive, but it does show that Highland Drive can accept that traffic.
So there is no shoulder really along Highland Drive, and just two lanes. You don't need any kind of improvements then to accommodate for a doubling of car trips?
As of right now, no, we don't. We've talked about improving the bus stop that currently sits right against our property there. We've also talked about proposing more trail connection from the existing Highlands Trail that would allow a little bit more of some meandering through our development. We do recognize that trail system is used by many, you know, walkers, joggers, hikers, and bikers. I would like to give them an opportunity to either get off that shoulder and get onto more of a meandering trail connection, or stay on that Highland Flats Trail. We've also proposed to update the underpass that goes underneath I-40 towards Silver Creek. So that would be a better and more friendly path to cross underneath the highway there.
All right. Does the Highland Drive then trail, it does remain? You just offer an alternative then through the property?
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right. And then in terms of the parking for 410 units, how many spaces are we talking about? And is it just open? Is it covered? Is it garaged?
You know, right now we've proposed 796 stalls. That's just under 2 stalls per unit. That is what current code for the zoning that we're looking for would require us to do so. We don't currently show on the plan any covered parking stalls. In a project like this, typically we would put some in. It just kind of depends ultimately to what the county would like to see going in there and if they ultimately feel like covered parking stalls would be necessary.
Okay. Because you mentioned that this is going to be a sustainable project, you could put solar panels on the parking stalls now?
Yeah, absolutely. Oftentimes when you build a parking stall that's covered, they tend to look more structure. So it tends to cover up more of the open or the green area. And typically when you see a field of solar panels, it can look, for lack of better terms, ugly as well. You know, so we would be open to completely being sustainable and solar panel energy if we can make that look right, where we are trying to build this project lower to the ground as it falls off of Highland Drive and drops towards I-80 to not interrupt the views of people over at Highland Estates. Unfortunately, they would be looking at the top of parking stalls, so we've got to be very cautious and careful at how we would design something like that.
All right, so how many buildings are we talking about?
Right now on our plat, we show 17 buildings. That could vary based on, you know, ultimately what could be approved.
All right. And then there are also some townhomes that are going to be built. I'm guessing these are the market rate units closer to Highland Drive. How many buildings there?
So in the townhomes, we've got about 8 different buildings for those. Mm-hmm. One thing to note with the subdivision and development is that the affordable units would be intermixed amongst all units. So you wouldn't feel like you have one area that's all affordable and one area that's market rate. So even some of our townhomes would be intermixed as some of that affordable rate unit.
All right. Now, given that they are all rentals, will there be a rental manager on site to take care of problems?
Yep, absolutely. So as the developer, we typically would develop the land and build the project. Once we're complete with that, we would retain ownership and hire a professional management company that would come in and manage the property and the tenants. And, you know, just for a better understanding of, you know, what we do, we are currently doing this with over 10,000 units.
Your promotional materials say that you're not taking any tax credits. What does that mean, and why is that a good thing?
So tax credits put a big burden back on the city systems when you come in and say, you know, we want affordability, but in doing so, we don't want to be paying for certain things, certain impact fees, certain permit fees. We're not asking for any of that. We're coming in and saying, we believe that this is something Park City needs. We believe that we can make this project pencil if we get the right number of units. We understand that that means a higher density, but it allows us to give more affordable units and also not ask for any tax credits because we don't want to be taking money from the city.
Okay. And as you mentioned, part of the proposal includes 10 acres for a future Catholic church proposal. So that's something that the Catholic diocese is looking for, land for, I mean, well, they've got the land, it sounds like, but they do plan to build a new church in that area?
Yes, they do. They don't have any currently designed. We've had multiple conversations with them as they continue to grow their religious use of buildings up there. They plan to build in the future a diocese there. Not sure what size or exact use outside of religious study of what it would be. We do show some kind of open parking there, not a ton of parking, you know, but that's kind of why we've said 10 acres should give them enough room for building a building and eventually updating the parking to whatever type of use they decide to use that for.
Okay, because right now I think I saw just 21 parking spaces for the church. That doesn't seem like nearly enough.
Yeah, and again, it kind of depends on what they end up using it for. You know, a typical church service, and oftentimes Catholic diocese do a child care program as well. If they were to do something like that, they would need more parking. Right now, the footprint of the building shows about a 10,000 square foot building or church that would go there. And what's required by code would be 21 stalls for that. But then that can fluctuate based on whatever they ultimately deem the use of the building for.
Okay. Again, as I mentioned, your proposal will be before the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission February 23rd. Is this a public hearing that's scheduled or just a work session?
Yep, this is a public hearing. And as this has kind of gotten out into public, as we've done some press release here, you know, we look forward to that public comment. We recognize that there will be a lot of mixed feeling with that and most likely some backlash, as we've already started to see on some of that. I have reached out in multiple areas trying to ask the community for what would be helpful for their community. And I know that that's really hard. I do recognize that this change is hard, and I'm sympathetic to that. But we can't do good and smart development if we don't have some feedback from the residents. So I actually do encourage the public to get on and speak during those moments, as we've seen a lot of questions and comments already come in. I'm also more than happy to take questions and comments directly to me and my staff of what this means. When I see a lot of comments come in saying affordability, what's affordability? I would love for people to understand what true affordability is. And I think if people did understand that a 30% AMI unit would rent at just under $600 a month, they might understand the reality that that is good, that is affordable, that we're not blowing smoke, that that is very true.
Okay, people can get more information. You've got a website, highlandflatspc.com. Adam, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate your time.
Adam Breen is with Breen Homes, again, bringing the proposal for the 410-unit rentals in Highland Estates to the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission February 23rd. On the phone now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Rich Bullo. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with an update then on the vaccine process. We're now exclusively taking care of our 70-over population?
Well, we're exclusively taking appointments for the 70 and over population. We still have a few of the Phase 1 group that had registered for appointments that are continuing through February. And so I'd estimate that probably 70-75% of our current appointments, the actual appointments, are for 70 plus. And as that Phase 1 group finishes up their first vaccines, that will inch closer to 100%.
Okay, so then when we need to start doing the second doses, does that mean that it's another delay?
Yeah, 28 days, at least 28 days, actually. And so we received, based on the vaccines that we received, the first doses, about 21 days later, we received the same number of second doses that are dedicated to match those first doses or boost those first doses. And so the minimum date for the Moderna vaccine that we have is 28 days. And, so the numbers, as we get more vaccines, more first dose vaccines, of course, the number of second doses goes up too. So the capacity at our current clinic, at our current point of distribution, just continues to ratchet up, and it's doing really well.
Now, there are some who believe that it's better that we get a single dose into everybody before we start doing the double doses. Do we have the science to back that up? I mean, there was some talk about it might be better to delay the second dose anyway.
Well, all I can depend upon is what the trials suggested, and that research has not been conducted. I know that in the UK, for example, they've shifted focus to the first dose. We've not done that. The state of Utah hasn't done it. And most jurisdictions in the United States have not done it. And in fact, Dr. Fauci spoke to this about a week ago and said that the science just simply isn't there. So we're continuing to follow the science, and we're dedicating second doses to boost those first doses.
So what are we seeing now in terms of the number of vaccine doses for the last 3 weeks? I mean, at one point, we were up to 900. We've seen 400 and everywhere in between.
We are bouncing around a little bit, and I'd like to explain that process. So last week, last Monday, not this current Monday, but a week ago Monday, we got 900 doses. I'm thrilled to say that this Monday of this week, we got 1,000 doses. And that is because, we're only officially allocated doses based on the census data. And so there's been a really significant shortfall of vaccines in Summit County. And unlike some counties, we've got a huge demand. The individuals living here in Summit County want the vaccine, and so our appointments are being booked out well ahead of time. And every morning, the health officers, all 13 of us across the state, get on the phone, and we talk about vaccines, talk about what health districts might have some extra doses because they don't have the demand that we have, for example. And so a week ago Monday, we got some doses shifted over to Summit County, and then this past week, this immediate Monday, got some additional doses shifted. Next week, we actually don't anticipate that. And the reason for that is that there's a very, very big shortfall in Salt Lake County and Southwest Health District. And if you think about Southwest, that's where St. George is. And so we agreed as health officers, basically shifting to where need is. And so this week, a significant number of doses, which will be delivered on Tuesday of next week, are being shifted to those health districts. And then the following week, Summit County will again be in line to receive additional doses. So we anticipate Tuesday of next week, we'll be receiving 600 doses, and then something greater than that the following week. And again, I'm speaking of first doses. Those numbers are just for first doses.
Right. So given that, then what is the timeline then for the rest of us here? I mean, we've got Elko, Nevada. They're already at 65 and over. I mean, how long is it going to take Summit County to get there?
Well, yeah, it's actually a little humorous to compare different communities in different states because every state has rolled this out differently. Mm. We prioritize teachers, and now we're prioritizing at-risk 70-plus. The governor did announce last week that we will be moving to include on March 1st, 65 to 69 that include, real severe conditions like uncontrolled diabetes, organ failure, immunocompromised due to cancer treatment, those kinds of things. So in that high-risk population of 65 to 69, March 1st, is when we're shooting for. We'll still be in the 70-plus group, though. And so specific to timeline, we are anticipating, so by the end of this week, and I'm thrilled to say this, by the end of this week, approximately half of the persons living in Summit County that are 70-plus will have received their first vaccine from Summit County Health Department. It's also important to note that people are going elsewhere because, as I said, the demand is not as great in some surrounding areas. So, for example, we know that some of our folks have driven to other health districts and even to Wendover, where they don't have any residency requirements, and they've received their first vaccines. And they are going to have to go back to those locations for the second dose. But the point is that we think, so from Summit County Health Department, by the end of the week, about 50% of the 70-plus. And we know that some proportion have gone elsewhere. So somewhere above 50% by the end of this week, we are, if you've not received, if you're 70-plus and you haven't received an email to be able to actually go in and register, you will next week. And so by the end of next week, we will be, we hope to have appointments for everybody, 70-plus. Those appointments, though, will continue into March. Again, because our demand, it's a nice problem to have. I understand that it creates some frustration on the part of the individuals waiting to be vaccinated. But the reason that we're having this shortage, despite the fact we're getting more doses, is because the demand is extremely high. And that is a great thing. That puts us in a really good position as we move into summer and fall to get back to some semblance of normalcy as a community, because our vaccine uptake, we believe, will be quite high.
All right. Another place apparently people are going is Spanish Fork. Monday there were 200 unfilled slots. So there, Utah County is taking other non-residents as well?
I can't speak to that specifically. I do know that Utah County, they've got a new health officer down there. His name's Eric Edwards. And Eric is being really progressive in ramping up multiple vaccination sites, and some of them are enormous. You know, they have a big population down there. And so Utah County was lagging a little bit behind for some period of time. They're now really ramping things up. And it, you know, it may be that those slots were available because of lack of demand, but it could also be because they've got all of these new points of distribution that they're ramping up, and perhaps people just aren't, you know, they're not registering for those doses yet. But Utah County is doing a really good job right now, and so I can't, you know, I can't speak to those specific vacancies or appointments that were available. But you know, if they're available, there are. Some health departments that are providing vaccines to individuals that don't live in those jurisdictions. And, for example, we know because our demand is so high and the wait time is consequently fairly long in Summit County, we do know that the latest data suggests that we're many, many times more people that live in Summit County are being vaccinated elsewhere than vice versa, us vaccinating individuals that don't live here. And for our 70-plus population, we are not. We require a Summit County address. And so we are not vaccinating individuals outside of Summit County.
Anymore,
correct. Yeah. In phase one, so teachers, first responders, you know, non-hospital healthcare providers, et cetera, we did. But moving forward, we have chosen to limit that.
So I heard news this morning that vaccines are making their way into our pharmacies. Does this mean that we'll do away with the vaccine center there at the film studio?
That's a great question. So first of all, to set some expectations, it's going to be a while before you can just go to a pharmacy and get a vaccine. You know, the state is basically priming the pump by delivering small numbers of doses, about 100 for a pharmacy, for example. It allows them to test their system, make sure they have the capacity. So it's going to be a while. And in fact, we, at this point in time, are not certain that this first rollout in the pharmacies is even going to occur in Summit County. Walmart, for example, in Summit County is not on the list for that rollout. So an important point is that health departments, the state is anticipating about 250,000 doses a week by the end of March. 120,000 of those doses will continue to go to local health departments. And so the plan is to be able to deliver the other 130,000 a week through other venues. That may include hospitals, providers' offices, pharmacies, and others, but we anticipate well into summer continuing to be the primary hub for vaccines in Summit County.
All right. Now that people have the vaccine, or some people have the vaccine, they feel like they're safe. But really, are they? I mean, can you just briefly talk about the protocols for those who have been vaccinated and then now planning to be around people who haven't been?
Great question. First of all, the current vaccines are really effective, but they're not 100% effective. And there's some evidence that they're not as effective for the variants that we're hearing about. And so we are still recommending, CDC is still recommending that you behave as if you've not been vaccinated. It is important to understand also that the data are not completely clear that being vaccinated prevents you from spreading the disease. It's very clear that it's effective in preventing you from getting sick, but you may still be spreading the disease, and those data are not clear yet. So it's very important, despite whether or not you've been vaccinated, both doses, that you continue to wear masks, continue to social distance, and continue to do all the things we've been talking about.
So where's the surge of increased cases from the variants that we've been hearing about? I mean, if these new variants are so transmissible, would we be down to less than 1,000 cases a day for 3 days in a row?
Another great question. First of all, I do want to take a moment and really relish the fact that our incidence rates are just plummeting. And that's, you know, I was this morning was on our website looking at our epi curve for new cases. And it's you know, I can't tell you how pleased I am to see those cases dropping. The variants are not real prevalent. As you know, they have been. The UK variant was identified in Summit County, but it isn't real common. So the state, for example, about every 50 positive tests, the state lab sequences the virus that is on that positive test and looking for these variants. They've only found a handful of cases across the state of Utah. To my knowledge, they've only found, they found the initial case in Summit County. And then that case, there were a couple of additional people that were exposed and became positive. So it's not common enough to drive a surge. That doesn't mean that we should take it for granted. It is the virus, the UK variant, is the primary variant that is driving the surge in the UK. So we should not take it for granted. And I think right now we should probably consider all of the efforts around prevention still critical to mitigating the spread of that particular variant.
Okay. Hey, Rich, as always, I've got more questions than time. I've got to leave it there. Thank you.
Okay.